to give aid to Western, to what do they call us, third world countries, countries starting to develop. If they're able to do that, it's on account of something which they took away from us once upon a time. In any event, when they left us with countries that were fairly advanced in the systems. But the advancement that had come, if it's a train, it's no problem. A train is a very, very neutral instrument, like a knife or a gun. Could be used for a good purpose, could be used for a bad purpose. But one of the things they left behind is an economy which is no longer agrarian. An economy which has become industrialized. And as an industrialized economy, there will be greater concentrations of wealth in the hands of certain individuals. The more concentration of wealth there is, the grounds open up for what? The grounds start open, the opportunity starts opening up for banks to start existing. So gradually they establish banks. And those banks would be nuskha tibq al-asl. It would be carbon copies of Western banks, operating on the simple principle of a Western bank. The simplest principle, the binary principle of a Western bank is what? Take deposits upon which you pay out a lower interest and give loans on which you demand a higher interest. You take deposits on 5%, you lend at 15%, 10% is your profit. It's as simple as that. So they brought us these banks. And these banks were seen as what? These banks were seen as the powerhouses of change, the powerhouses of industrialization. Those who were the captains of industry in Muslim society, those who were the political masters, they had one major concern in their minds. We are behind Europe, we need to catch up. We are behind Europe, we need to catch up. And some went the route of saying, what is the cause of our being so much behind the rest of the world? Some looked at it and said, is this deen of ours? This deen of ours which teaches up about Jannah and Jahannam, about jinn and ins and all of these other things, we can't believe in, na'udhu billah, fairy tales any longer. We need to get rid of it, lock, stock and barrel, and then you find Kemalist Turkey of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who thought that deen, it is religion which is keeping us behind, we need to jettison it, lock, stock and barrel. Need to get rid of it, and then become as atheistically material as possible, and then alone, we will be able to get away from being the sick man of Europe, which Turkey was being described as in those days. And others saw that we won't throw away our deen, but we will compromise on some aspects of it. We'll have these banks because we need these banks. Talat Harb, the Egyptian prime minister at the time, was the head of an Egyptian bank, Al-Bank Al-Ahli Al-Misri, the Egyptian National Bank. And he used those banks to build the industries which are still the backbone of Egypt, the Egyptian economy up to today, the cotton industry, etc. How would it happen? People would give deposits. All of those monies would be used to channel into these industries, and profits from there will be used to pay out eventually to the people, but not in a mudaraba kind of way, in the normal riba way. Take deposits at low interest and give loans at high interest, and that's how it works. So they thought that's the only way out. We can only do it in that way. And for a long time it continued that way. We were suffering from inferiority complexes. We thought we were behind the rest of the world. We even started imagining that our fiqh is outdated. We started imagining that our fiqh is suffering from stagnation because our fiqh cannot quite match up to the advances in medicine, the advances in economy, the advances in the physical sciences. It's outdated. And then comes the kind of descriptor where they say the jumud, the asrul jumud, the age of stagnation of fiqh. I beg to differ. There was no age of stagnation. All that had happened was that when change takes place in a society at a normal pace, then fiqh catches up after a while. A question, something new, a nazila, a new exigency arises. How often? Once in 5, 10 or 20 years. And there are great fuqaha who will then solve the problem and it will move on. And that's how fiqh developed for 1,000 years. But suddenly, we were given not one or two or three nawazil. We were left with a barrel full of them at the same time. How much of it can you answer all at once? And therefore, the fuqaha found themselves on the back foot. It took some time for us to catch up and say, let's now start solving the problem. But too much at once, you try to munch it down and you get stuck. It all cannot be at the same time. So when fiqh couldn't adequately answer the questions, it was said, fiqh is stagnant, back to Qur'an and Sunnah. Let's go back to Qur'an and Sunnah, that's where we'll find all the answers, take the madhahib and cast them behind our backs. No, it was no time of jumud. It was a time of encountering the problem. It was a time of culture shock. It was a time of an overload in the system that couldn't immediately be solved. But the overload will eventually start getting solved. So gradually, Gradually came the age of our enlightenment. There came about the age of what now? Rising from the ashes. Rising from the ashes of what was burned down by colonialism. They started rising the phoenix of reasserting our own identity in light of our own Sharia. You might have given us banks, we will Islamize them. You might have given us this, we will take them and look at the principles of our fiqh, because like our fiqh, there's no other legal system in the world. Why is it? Yes, there are very advanced legal systems, but how many of them can claim to have Allah Ta'ala as its originator? To have Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam as the one who conveyed it. To have the likes of Abu Hanifa, Shafi'i, Layth ibn Sa'd, Malik, Sufyan al-Thawri as the ones who developed it further. And all the fuqaha that came afterwards, with the piety, with the devotion associated with that, with the sincerity that went into all of that. Sayyidina al-Imam Shafi'i, rahmatullahi alayhi, used to say, someone asked the question, that you find Imam Shafi'i at the same time, you find a person like another faqih, Yahya ibn Aktham at the same time. There's a faqih. The one dies and his madhab spreads over the whole world. The other one dies, his name dies. What's the difference between the two? The answer was given, because Imam Shafi'i rahmatullahi alayhi used to say, وَدِدْتُ أَنَّ النَّاسَ أَخَذُوا هَذَا الْعِلْمَ عَنِّي ثُمَّ لَا يَنْسِبُونَ إِلَيَّ حَرْفًا مِّنْهُ. It's my wish that people would take this knowledge from me, that Allah has given me, but not a word of it must be ascribed to me. They have it in English. There's no limit to what a man can achieve if he doesn't care who gets the credit. Neither Abu Hanifa, nor Malik, nor Ash-Shafi'i, nor Ahmad ibn Hanbal rahimahullah cared who got the credit. For them it was what? Service liwajhillah. Khidmah for the sake of Allah Ta'ala. Therefore, there's no other legal system which can compare with it in terms of origin, in terms of the fuqaha who contributed to it. And then most important, and this is the only legal system in the world which harmonizes with the purpose of creation. It is not just in order to regulate affairs on this particular world, but in order to determine which of the two sides are you going to go to in the akhirah as well. So it's the only one that covers both sides of it. All other legal systems will lose this world and nothing else. And when you come to death, you know, it's a matter of eat, drink and be merry, because tomorrow you die and there's nothing beyond that. Well, we go beyond that. Gradually, starting from the early 1900s, Muslims started looking at their deen once again. And we are still in the stage in which we are grappling. We are still not the dominant civilization in the world. But the wheel is turning. وَتِلْكَ الْأَيَّامُ نُدَاوِلُهَا بَيْنَ النَّاسِ. The wheel of history turns. We who are on top once upon a time, we turn right down to the bottom. And being at the bottom, there are certain lessons which we can learn. And we can learn lessons from those before us who had also been at the bottom. But Allah's wheel turns. Nothing stays the way that it is. And suddenly you find, coming out of the 1950s, people start reasserting themselves. We are Muslims and we need to live our lives and govern our countries, govern ourselves in line with our Sharia. These Muslim countries get independence from their colonial overlords. The first thing they start doing, well, we need to reassert the area of personal law, nikah, talaq, etc. They start codifying laws. All the other laws are basically Western. It will be the code Napoleon from Egypt, France coming to Egypt, or the Swiss code being taken into Turkey and so on. But the one area in which he said, no, we are Muslims, nikah and talaq. Yes, with some adaptations and changes and whatever it might be, but by and large drawn from the Sharia Islamiyah. That was the first step. The second step, they started thinking, civil law in our country, the law of muamalat in our countries, and they remain, in most of these Muslim countries, still not Islamized. They are still based upon the Western system. Why? Because commerce of the world in which they live is basically based upon the Western model. But gradually scholars start thinking in the direction of where do we want to go? As we have managed to a certain degree to Islamize our family lives, our nikahs are still happening by ijab and qabool, be it in the masjid, be it in the qadi's court, our talaqs are still being dealt with by the ulama, whether it be with the ulama organization or the courts of the qadis. Now similarly, we want to gradually reassert our control over other areas of our Sharia as well. The next area that we turned to thereafter was what? Commerce. Mid Ghamr project. In the 1960s or the 1970s, an Egyptian economist looks at this matter. He says, man, we have to start a pilot project to see whether the theory of what we have in our law, because for 200, 300, 400 years now, our fiqh has been relegated to where? To the books only. And all of us who have studied Muamalat, I'll tell you my own story. Muamalat, we're coming to the bab of what? Bayr, okay? And the next bab after Bayr, speaking of the Shafi'i books now, is Riba. So The only riba that I ever knew of in my life was when my mother goes to put money onto my little bank account, then there's written in red so much is interest, and she takes it out and she gets rid of it somehow. That's the only riba we ever knew. So I'm waiting now. When are you going to learn about banks? Well, I see nothing of banks in there. All I see is dates and salt, and then a bit of gold and silver. And the fiqh, the mu'amalat, the riba that we meet in the fiqh, which one is that? That is riba al-fadl and riba al-nasiya. You know, the riba al-qurud barely features in there. It barely features in there because that was the riba that was prevailing and predominant into society for which that fiqh was written. Now we're back into society where riba is back the way it was, like it was in Makkah Mukarramah. The old riba al-qurud once again. So the answers are not there in the tafsil, in the detail. The answers are there in the ijmal of what's in our fiqh. The ijmal of what's in there. The overarching principles that would be in there, that's where the answer would lie. And it's become something which is ma'loom min ad-deen bid-darura. It is something undeniably and categorically part of our sharia. Who knows it? You know it. I know it. Even the non-Muslim knows it, that Muslims do not take riba. What, how much they understand of riba is a different thing, but everyone is aware of the fact that Muslims do not take riba. There's just, and everyone for this past 200-300 years, whatever, they are basically just two rules of muamalat that they knew. Because when fiqh is to be studied for the sake of teaching people, is the ibadat. The muamalat, the ulama would read it. How much of it they would practice is a different thing. But anyway, there's just two rules that they know. Riba is haram is the one. And the other strange one is this, that you cannot sell goods for more than 100% profit. Now, I first of all heard about that here in Cape Town, I say, man, I've never come across a rule like that. This must be one of our late local Cape Townianisms. We've got our own kind of fiqh over there. It's based upon just a few usul. But it's one of those Cape Townianisms, I thought. And then I came to this, I went to India, I found the same thing there. Someone is saying the same thing over there. They say, oh, Cape Townian fiqh has spread up to here, mashallah. Then I go to Egypt and I find the same question. Dr. Qaradawi in his Fatawa Mu'asara has to answer a similar question over there. So some of the other Muslims have imagined certain things. You know, in the lack of adequate education about it, what happens? People just start, what's this now? They start making up certain things. This is also Sharia. So there was this great lack of knowledge that people have about Mu'amalat. There were certain attempts to write certain things, but those few attempts to write normally lacked the practical side. First of all, because they are based upon fiqh books that were written for a very agrarian economy. And in that agrarian economy, you and I who have studied the fiqh books, you can very clearly see, here comes an-nahi an talaqqi rukban. Don't go out to the caravans that are coming. You can't do that. Why? To keep the market stable. Don't start interfering with the ard al-talab, the supply and demand. Let the market be as free, as natural as possible. Let people interact. دَعِ النَّاسِ يَرْزُقِ اللَّهِ بَعْضَهُمْ مِنْ بَعْضٍ. Don't interfere. You can see the farmer coming in. You can see the purchaser, the mushtari, the purchaser coming into the ba'i' and saying that بِعْتُ, and the other one will say اشْتَرَيْتُ. You can see that happening. But we don't live in that age. We live in the age where I take my mouse and I click on Amazon.com and with my credit card number I bought a book. That's the age in which we are living. So people find it difficult to take those old muamalat. Look, they're as valid as can be, but the expression, the mode of packaging them is not always as easily understandable in this modern world in which we live. So these are the problems that we studied those books. The books were studied from cover to cover. We went through those muamalat. We're still doing it. But as I discovered, and as many others would have discovered, you take that, you come into the modern world, and you try and translate it into practice. It's not impossible, but it's a gargantuan task. It's a momentous task. It takes more than one person. It takes more than an academy of people sitting together to do that particular job. But alhamdulillah, such is the resilience of the ummah of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam that there will be those who will stand up for that particular challenge. There will be those. And the Mid Ghamr project starts. Ahmad al-Zayyat, I think it was, the Egyptian economist. What does he do? He says, look, man, we can do something. We have a certain principle of how to do muamalat. We have a certain principle of how to do investment. So the farmers of that particular location, he says, all of you, let's start a savings project. As an alternative to a riba bank scheme, let's start a savings project. All of you give your savings, we put it in here. Then other farmers who need money, we give it to them on a mudaraba. And then they will pay back. and the scheme ran for a few years, successful, everyone is participating, everyone eating halal, and then start the wars between Egypt and Israel, and sometimes they win and sometimes they lose. Well, you ask the Egyptians, they won all of those wars, even the ones that they lost, they won. So the war interferes, and after a while the project comes to an end. The project did not continue to become a major alternative bank, but what it did succeed in doing, is telling everyone that it can be done. It's not impossible. It can be done if enough people put their hearts, their minds, and their pocket to the tasks. It's something that is possible. Meet Ghamr project starts back then in the 1970s. 40 years later, where we stand today, Islamic Finance is controlling, 2 years ago, the figures were $822 billion up to $1 trillion. An industry that started from what? A few farmers putting their savings together and starting a savings scheme such as this. And the savings scheme like barely lasted a decade, but it proved the viability of what we have. And suddenly you find one after the other, banks start opening, conventional banks start opening windows, because a few years before this collapse happened, the recent collapse, a friend was told by an economist, American economist who was here at Wits University, speaking about Islamic finance, he says that, these people have studied the trends, and like these are Ayyam Nudawi Duhabain and us, commerce in the world, it's not a secret, there are trends that happen, and they can predict. That's why we have Bloomberg's and we have Reuters and all of these people. They're not as much into this kind of news as they are into what? Commercial news. To predict the trends of what will happen tomorrow. So what happens? They are predicting that things will, you know, when a balloon is blowing up and up and up, and it's filled by all of these fanciful things such as derivatives and futures and options and all these empty kind of things, the balloon is just getting bigger and bigger. And it doesn't take a genius to predict that at some point it's going to burst. And they say, when that bubble eventually does burst, the only thing remaining standing firmly will be this Islamic form. This Islamic form of finance and commerce. 2 years ago also, somewhere in April 2009, who of all people? The very organization that identified Islam as the new enemy. The very person that went to Regensburg University and delivered an address in which he says that if you look at Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, you see nothing but savagery. That very same Benedict, the 16th or 17th, whichever he is, that very same Catholic Church would announce in its mouthpiece, La Osservatore or something like that, the paper. They say that perhaps the solution lies for the world's economic and financial problems. Perhaps they need to go to the Muslims. And the ethical foundations of Islamic finance is where the answer would lie. If ever there was a medal placed on the chest of the Sharia of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, فَالْفَضْلُ مَا شَهِدَتْ بِهِ الْأَعْدَاءُ. When the enemy says it's great, then most certainly it is great. You and I can say we have a great Sharia. But when the enemy, that very same organization which has identified us as the enemy, the new enemy, communism is gone. When they do such a thing, you know, this Pope has said, I didn't mean what I said at Regensburg, I didn't mean it in that way. This man is one of the sharpest diplomats in the world that you can find. He was the main diplomat for the church when he was a cardinal. Every word that he speaks is well considered. He was making a very, very clear statement at the time. When this man is forced into saying that in the ethical foundations of Islamic finance lies the solution to the economic problems of the West, I think that is something to be taken with a great amount of pride on the side of Muslims. We take pride in the Sharia of ours, in this divine, with its divine origins, with its prophetic roots, and in the manner in which it was unpacked, unfurled, and detailed by the Fuqaha of Islam. The answer to the world problem lies there. What is it all about? This thing that contains the answer to the world's problems. Everything up to this moment was just an introduction. The historical introduction to what is Islamic finance. The world of finance is a multifaceted one. One can basically break it down to three different areas. Those three areas I would call banking, asset management and investment, number two, and then the third one, insurance. These are the three areas that we can divide this particular industry into. In banking now, What happens in banking? Now, once upon a time, a bank was a monolithic entity. All that it did was take deposits, give loans. Banks have outgrown that particular monolithic image a long time ago. It's no longer that monolithic image. What is it now? You look at major South African banks, what do they have? They have 150, 200 different branches to them. They involved in just about every kind of activity, good and bad. So banks cannot be reduced to that monolith of deposits and loans any longer. But that remains the essence, that remains at the core. So that is what I will call what? Banking. Just the what side? The depositing side, I'll call that banking. Transactional banking. That is when you and I sit with our excess money, and what do we do with them? Now, this problem was faced by our parents and our grandparents before them. What do you do with your money? Do you keep it at home under the mattress? Or do you take it to a bank and keep it there for safekeeping? At that time, I don't think there was a single faqih who disagreed with the fatwa that says you can place it in the bank for the sake of what we all said, darura. What do you do? Everyone knows what's happening under the mattress. So you simply can't keep it there. Yes, there will still be those few individuals who refuse. And Allah Ta'ala bless them for that. Who refuse to place their monies in any sort of banks. If so be their preference, فَبِهَا وَنَعِمَتْ blessed be they in that regard. But almost none of our ulama, I'm not aware, someone should inform me if there is, but almost none of our ulama disagreed on the point that while it is a transaction of riba that you're involved in when you're putting your money in the bank. When you're putting your money in the bank, you enter into a contract. There's a contract, that's why you sign all of those papers. And that contract basically boils down to one thing. You are the muqrid, the bank is the mustaqrid. You are the giver of the loan, the bank is the taker of the loan. The bank takes your loan and it gives you interest periodically. So while they said for the sake of darura, because one of the maqasid of the sharia is what? Hifdhul mal. We keep it at home. Well, you try and keep money at home in South Africa today, Johannesburg especially. I was in Medina Munawwara recently, and an Arab brother comes and he says, please man, I want to come study English in South Africa. And the brother's with me is telling him, okay, fine, where do you want to go? You want to go to Cape Town or you want to go to Johannesburg? So the guy says, you tell me where to go. So my friend he's from up country, he says, don't go to Cape Town. You know, the women, they are so wild, you'd rather come to Joburg. So I say, well, you can go to Joburg, but you know, the amount of crime, you'll probably stay 1 week and they'll rob you. He said, I'm going to Cape Town, I'm not going to Joburg. So this is the kind of society which we're living in, the kind of robberies, and back then it wasn't that bad. And then already our ulama said, you can place the funds in there. Knowing that's a riba contract that you're entering into, you're going to be collecting riba, and what did they say? Some said, don't take the riba out at all, just leave it in there. Some said, take it out. And now comes the question, what do you do with it? Do you give it to the poor? Do you give it to public organizations? And as some would say, do you even take it for yourself? There have been even fatawa of those nature. Alhamdulillah, as far as I'm aware of, not here with us. Okay, I'm aware of one. But this door was never publicly opened. But it is getting rid of something haram. It is admission of the fact that I'm doing something haram, I need to do something about it. But it's for the sake of darura, so such be it. So that's the one side of banking. What transactional banking? Having a current account, having a savings account, that's the one side of banking. That is probably your least problematic area. The second side of banking would be what? Financing. By which, what I mean, where the bank then provides finance loans to people to do, to buy cars, to buy houses, to fund their businesses, whatever the case might be. This has been the most contentious side of banking, the most contentious side of mu'amalat in general, and it is not a product of the modern era. This has been problematic in our ummah from the time of the Sahaba radiallahu anhum already. When we start looking for the alternative to riba, when I give you 1,000 and I expect 1,500 back, when we start looking at the alternative to riba, I provide you my financing, what can I get back? So, what are the alternatives? The alternatives, the most ethical alternative is what? Give it qard hasan. Give a qard hasan. Man dha alladhi yuqridu Allah qardan hasan fayudha'ifahu lahu. Allah Ta'ala will give you so much more back. But see, that's akhirah. Our sight is, we are sometimes short-sighted. I want something back here. I want something back here now. So, it's not bad. Depends on the manner in which you're going to get it back. To want some returns, not a problem. So you say, okay, I'm going to give it to you. You just give me back something more than that. No, not permissible. But if you say, what do you want it for? Business? Okay. Why don't you make me your mudaraba partner in the business? 100% correct. Mudaraba, as I said earlier, was one of the most powerful manners in which we affected the West and the rest of the world for that matter. However, it's not always for business that the person wants it. Mudaraba only works if it's business. He's going to trade with it. Because there is a generation of an income from them. That income can be shared. What if it's a car that he wants to buy? What if it's a house that he wants to buy? It's an asset that he wishes to acquire. How do you use mudaraba for him to acquire an asset? You're not going to use the car as a taxi. It's not going to generate a stream of income. So there's no profit sharing. Mudaraba cannot do that. We come back to where? Go to the Qard Hasan. The Qard Hasan, unfortunately, this is the dunya, and people have these, you know, it's my money, I've worked for it, I want something back. Again, praised and blessed be he who gives his money in the Qard Hasan, and Allah Ta'ala will give him so much back in the Akhirah. But while that works at an individual level, you and your friend and his friend, brother and brother, brother and sister, father and son, it is simply not efficient, not attractive enough to work at an institutional level. Show any bank that will do a Qard Hasan. There's no money to be made out of it. They've got people that they need to pay. They've got shareholders that want returns on it. So it's not on. Cannot work. In the early days of Kemalist Turkey, there was a muhaddith in Turkey. What was his name now? Ahmad Rida Gumushkhanawi. Gumushkhanawi lived in the north of Turkey. Great muhaddith he was, mashallah. And when he saw the manner in which Western banks were starting to dominate Turkish economic society, he got together some of his friends and murids and so on and told them that we need to start an alternative. Sheikh Gumushkhanawi got them all together, said, all of you are the rich people, you are the traders, you put money into a central pool. From here we will give Qard Hasan, we will give non-interest based loan to those who require it, and they will then pay it back. Good idea, excellent idea, ethically very, very sound, commercially very, very flawed. Why? Because traders after a while will say, man, I could have used that money for myself. Why should I give it over there? And then they will draw their funds from it. That's the one side. And the mustaqrir, the person taking the loan, says, man, these are good people. They won't worry if I don't pay back. And then you start finding default. So the whole system comes plunging in. Simply doesn't work. It was tried. They attempted it. It didn't work. Before that, in the time of Sultan Sulaiman Qanuni, known as Sulaiman the Magnificent, there was this big debate in Turkey on the issue of waqfun nuqud. Can you make money waqf? Now you can make so many things you can make waqf. Can you make money waqf? Now the basic position in the Hanafi madhab, the Shafi'i madhab as well, money can't be made waqf. But in both madhabs there's an alternative, non-rajih opinion, that says money can be made waqf. The mufti of the time was Mufti Abu Sa'ud al-Imadi. Abu Sa'ud, the author of the famous tafsir, Irshad al-Aql al-Salim ila mazaya al-Quran al-Kareem. He was the mufti of the Dawla Uthmaniyya. He was known as the one to reconcile the Qanun with the Sharia under the rule of Sultan Sulaiman al-Qanuni, which was probably the apogee of the Ottoman Empire. It reaches its furthest expansion during those times. Now there was this big debate. Can you have money been made waqf or not? Those who made money waqf, those awqaf of money, those were your banks of the Ottoman Empire. You make a certain amount of money waqf, people will come and take from there and they have to repay. But the same problem we face once again. And we know it amongst our people how it is. Again, men, these are Allah walas, they won't worry. In fact, the problem with that is that as a system, as an institution, it's not viable. Those who gave it will benefit. Those who did not repay, whatever, may they be forgiven for that. But as a system, we could not develop an alternative system on the basis of altruism, on the basis of I give and don't expect anything in return. Because someone will abuse. And someone or some of the givers will lose interest after a while. So that was the one. So Abu Sa'ud Effendi, Abu Sa'ud al-Imadi, his idea was waqf al-nuqud while being marjuh. But he went there, he says, we have to open this door. We have to open these fatwas, you can give it. At the same name was Allama Birgiwi. Birgiwi was a faqih as well, more of a Sufi person. He wrote several rasail against this thing. This cannot be because people, they use it in the wrong way. Some of the mutawallis of those awqaf, what they would do is that they would give the money to the person, or they're supposed to do it in one of two ways. Either as a Qard Hasan or as a mudaraba. If it's a Qard Hasan, that means he has to repay the capital. If Because the Mudaraba has to come share prophets. Now they don't keep proper books. So you never know what's a proper prophet. And then sometimes the fellow just disappears and you don't know what happened. So they started dealing with it as how the mutawalli of the waqf start treating it as a waqf. I'm giving you 1,000, you need to pay me 1,200. No mudaraba, no nothing. So it started becoming a pure ribawi endeavor. And therefore Allama Birjiwe said, no, this thing cannot be. Fine. That was in the 1500s. We're back here now where? We're back in the 1900s, 1970, moving on to 1980, moving on to 1990. And all of these banks are, the idea is becoming, is growing in strength. From day to day, from month to month, you start finding fully fledged Islamic banks. Now here, our South African experience tells us, I think the first move in that direction was, those who remember from the 80s, Jami' Limited. Jami' Limited started as a kind of South African mid-ghamr scheme. Put money together, it was an old MYM scheme. You put money together and some people benefit from it. What the reasons were for the collapse, I cannot say. I was a child at the time. All I know is Jami Limited collapsed. And then when